Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program, broadcasting to you live today from Los Angeles, California. It seems that everyone in America wants to be famous. What's perhaps even more troubling, younger Americans seem to think they are quite certain one day they will be famous. Jake Halpern is a writer and producer for National Public Radio's program All Things Considered. He's written a new book entitled Fame Junkies, I Couldn't Put It Down. It's just that interesting. It's a diagnosis of a central problem in our culture, and especially among the young, who think that the whole point of life is to be famous. And by the way, if you can't be famous, you may be infamous. And in our postmodern culture, the line between fame and infamy is growing thinner and harder to see all the time. Jake Halpern is going to be our guest coming up in just a few moments on this program. We're going to be talking about what it means for American citizens to turn themselves into fame junkies, watching lifestyles of the rich and famous and sending their kids off to school to figure out and learn how to be the next child star. We're living in very interesting times, and of course our times right now are focused, as we are Christians, looking for the celebration of the resurrection, not only every Lord's Day and every day lived in light of the resurrection, but of course that Sunday known by most Christians as Easter Sunday is coming, and you can expect this time of year there's a great deal of attention in the media to this. That explains why there are the cover stories in the national news magazines, the documentaries on the cable news programs, and all the rest. Most of them attempting to give something of a sleight of hand to Christianity, something of a redefinition or a call for revising the faith. The Discovery Channel's program, The Lost Family Tomb of Jesus, we've covered extensively because it is itself a phenomenon of the age. Here you have James Cameron, the producer and director of the blockbuster movie Titanic, still holds the box office records here in the United States, lending his own prestige and name to a documentary by Simka Yakubovich that is so thin on the evidence that it becomes laughable. When the New York Times, in its movie review or media review, says that the Discovery Channel will rue the day it rediscovered this supposed lost tomb of Jesus because of its own credibility, you know that something's going on here. But what I find far more interesting than the phenomenon of this documentary is the response of so many liberal theologians and liberal church persons to this, saying it wouldn't be a big deal, it wouldn't make a big deal if the bones of Jesus were found, if it were discovered that Jesus did not rise from the dead. Yesterday on this program, we devoted our conversation to that, looking at Rabbi Mark Gelman, a Jewish rabbi who says, maybe I've been misunderstanding what you Christians have been saying for 2,000 years, but if I understood it, it would make a big difference if Jesus was not raised from the dead. Of course, we face the same thing now with A.N. Wilson. I wrote about it today at my website at albertmohler.com. It's an important article. I would commend it to you. You can go to my article. You can link directly to A.N. Wilson's article. In order to understand the importance of this, you need to understand who Mr. Wilson is. He's a very famous British man of letters, an historian, best-selling author. He is a well-educated man. He's a part of the intellectual class in Britain. He was himself a candidate for the Anglican priesthood until he lost his faith. He speaks of his own experience as something of a deconversion from Christianity to skepticism. He says he's no longer a Christian, but he's a Christian fellow traveler, which means he thinks Christianity has an important contribution to make to the society, but he's not a believer himself. He does, however, understand how central the resurrection is to the Christian faith. In other words, Mr. Wilson understands the faith he now rejects. In an article published in the Sunday Herald Sun, that in Australia, this past Sunday, he made two crucial points. In the first place, he stressed the fact that if it were proved that Jesus Christ did not rise from the dead, Christianity must necessarily fall. His second point is accurate and is as important as his first point. He said there's no form of proof adequate to the challenge of proving that Jesus Christ was not raised from the dead. What Mr. Wilson seems to understand, and yet so many who call themselves Christians seem not to get, is that Christianity without resurrection is no longer Christianity. I want to read to you from Mr. Wilson's article. He says, if such a find, that is a lost tomb of Jesus with bones, were to be found, it would be historically revolutionary. It would prove, among other things, that the traditional Christian belief was false, that Jesus did not rise from the dead. Long ago, Paul the Apostle wrote to his friends in Corinth that if Christ did not rise from the dead, their faith was in vain. No doubt, if Cameron's find were to be proved authentic, it would destroy the Christian religion. The Pope could shut up shop. The Church of England could be absorbed by the National Trust as just a collection of medieval buildings. Unbelievers in the resurrection would feel that their skepticism had been justified, and the vast majority of Christian believers who profess their faith in Christ risen from the dead would be compelled to admit their faith had been based on a mistake, end quote. Well, he's exactly right. Now, again, he made two points. The second point is there is no possible proof to prove that Jesus was not raised from the dead. But here you have someone who claims to have such truth and yet claims it would not materially impact Christianity. Mr. Wilson rejects Christianity, but he gets the point. Now, I went on to cite something else I think is of great importance, because another man wrote an article published on the same day about the resurrection. And in this case, this man, Steve Gushy, the Palm Beach Post in Florida, argues that Christians wouldn't have to worry that Christianity would fall if the resurrection of Christ were disproved. He said this: "The claim that one, that is one of the tombs, held the bones of Jesus of Nazareth is highly unlikely. The documentary assumes much and conjectures more to make its case. Even if true, that should not destroy faith in Jesus' resurrection. It might restore a measure of spiritual integrity to a faith awash in false literalism." In other words, Steve Gushy says it might actually be good news to find out Jesus wasn't raised from the dead, because then we could liberate Christianity from this, well, let me give you his words again, false literalism. Well, Mr. Gushy, I don't know where in the world you're getting this. I don't know how you are coming up with this, but Christianity without the resurrection doesn't explain why people would go to their deaths for the claim that Jesus Christ was bodily raised from the dead. It doesn't make any sense out of the early church. It doesn't make any sense in the witness of the New Testament, and it doesn't make any sense now. Mr. Gushy went on to write, "A seminary dean told me 40 years ago that even if someone dug up the body of Jesus, he would not believe in that cadaver, but in the Jesus embraced by the community that proclaims his resurrection." You see, here we face the old argument all over again. Liberal theology early in the 20th century started to make a distinction between the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith, arguing that the Jesus of history is simply a figure that can be known through historical investigation, but the church believes not in the Jesus of history, but in the Christ of faith, a Christ that is believed to, for instance, be born of a Virgin Mary, to have performed miracles, to be fully God and fully man, to have been raised from the dead, and all the rest. Well, here's the bottom line. The Jesus of history is the Christ of faith, or there is no Christianity. That's the bottom line. If the Jesus of history is not the Christ of faith, then Christianity is a lie. I'm very thankful that it is not. And it is fundamentally unhelpful to have liberal theologians trying to suggest that you can have Christianity without the bodily resurrection of Christ. In California, Congressman Pete Stark has announced that he is an unbeliever in God. Now, what makes this interesting is that a group of freethinkers, of non-believers, did a survey trying to find the highest-ranking elected official that did not believe in God. A member of American Atheists of California nominated Stark. The Secular Coalition for America said that his group wanted to highlight how hard it was for politicians to take a public stance about not believing in God. He says the members of his group were, quote, pleasantly surprised, end quote, with Pete Stark's candor. Very, very interesting. The American Humanist Association plans to take out an ad in the Washington Post congratulating the congressman for his public stance and highlighting the contributions of other prominent secular humanists, such as writers Barbara Ehrenreich and Kurt Vonnegut and actress Julia Sweeney. Well, it tells you something, that they've got to go reaching for some isolated celebrities to try to throw up here. It turns out that most of the people they uncovered in looking for America's highest elected official who declared himself or herself to be an unbeliever, most of them were municipal and local officials of one sort or another, but they did find one U.S. congressman. Now, wait till you hear this. Listen to this. This is a statement made by the congressman in response to this survey and his answer. He served in Congress since 1973. He's a Democrat and now chairs the Health Subcommittee of the House Ways and Means Committee. In an email, he told the Los Angeles Times this, quote, "When the Secular Coalition asked me to complete a survey on my religious beliefs, I indicated I am a Unitarian who does not believe in a supreme being. Like our nation's founders, I strongly support the separation of church and state. I look forward to working with the Secular Coalition to stop the promotion of narrow religious beliefs in science, marriage contracts, the military, and the provision of social services," end quote. Okay, let's just think seriously here for a moment. They were looking for America's highest ranking official that does not believe in God. We have no meter to read the souls of men and women. I am quite certain that there are many who would use what they would claim to be a faith for political purposes when they actually have no saving knowledge of Jesus Christ as Lord. As a Christian, I'm frankly more concerned about that. But it is interesting that out of the 435 members of the House and the 100 members of the United States Senate, they found one. And this one man, nonetheless, has pledged to use his full one vote to stop the promotion of narrow religious beliefs in science, marriage contracts, the military, and the provision of social services. One man, one vote, one Unitarian in the Congress. Headlines in the Los Angeles Times. That alone tells you a lot about the times in which we live. We'll be back to talk about why Americans are infatuated with fame and why Christians should be concerned about this. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, this is the Albert Miller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. I hold here in my hands a book that I have found nothing less than fascinating. It's by Jake Halpern, a columnist with National Public Radio. The book is Fame Junkies. Subtitle is The Hidden Truths Behind America's Favorite Addiction, and it really is frightening stuff. Let me just kind of give you the flavor of the book. Basically, he's arguing that Americans are now and have been increasingly becoming infatuated with the idea of celebrity and fame. But it's not just that they're looking at this, as Americans often have in recent decades, from a distance. In other words, looking at famous Hollywood celebrities and in an unhealthy way, just fascinated with every aspect of their lives. They now think that they will or certainly could become famous themselves. And that's what makes things all the different now. Jake Halpern has written fascinating stuff indicating, for instance, that young Americans are now coming to the conclusion that they ought to be famous. I'm reading here from his book. He's citing a man says here, any kid who's watching TV or just paying attention to the world around them has got to come to the conclusion that being famous brings an awful lot of things that can make your life better. That said by Robert Thompson, a specialist and academic that views popular culture in America. Jake Halpern's now with us. He is the author of this book, Fame Junkies. It is a fascinating read. He is also himself an independent producer for National Public Radio, where I have heard his voice for many years. Jake Halpern, welcome to the Albert Miller Program.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
I'm glad to have you. I have to tell you, you have written one of the most fascinating and frightening books I've read in a long time.
Oh, well, thanks, I guess.
Well, I thanks is due, because this is the kind of thing we need to know if we're going to understand our culture. Why did you write a book about Americans as fame junkies? What's going on here?
Well, I think that one of the reasons is that we tend to not look at this as an issue that warrants serious consideration. I mean, I think we all have this understanding that we live in a culture that is celebrity obsessed, that puts an enormous premium on fame. But we ultimately, I think, tend to see this as a benign distraction, as where's really the harm? And one of the first things I did with the book was I did a survey of about 700 American teenagers and asked them a number of questions. And some of the results were immediately kind of startling, one of which was I asked teenagers, if you could press a magic button that would make you stronger, smarter, more beautiful, or famous, which would you pick? And boys picked fame almost as often as intelligence, and girls picked fame more often than intelligence. So I'd been working on this survey with some people at Syracuse University, and when I started to see these stats come in, I was all the more kind of convinced that this was a subject matter that merited more serious consideration, and there were kind of some dark implications here that we tended to overlook.
Well, let's draw out some of those dark implications. I have to tell you that there's a lot of heartache, indeed heartbreak, in your book. I think particularly of how you document these parents and grandparents and others pushing forward children in order to be child actors and actresses. This is really not a pretty picture you paint here.
No, it's not. And I went out to Los Angeles and attended one of these fame conventions. It's run by something called the International Model and Talent Agency. And it's a little bit like that movie Miss Sunshine. I mean, the kids perform on stage and the parents are cheering. This whole industry has been greatly boosted and fueled by the success of American Idol. So you've got parents that are paying anywhere between $5,000 to $10,000 to go out for a 4-day weekend and have their kid get a chance at being discovered. And I definitely saw a lot of what would be the classic stage mom scenario or stage dad, where they were pushing the kid hard and seemed to be living somewhat vicariously through the kids' achievements. But what really struck me and surprised me was the number of families I saw where the kids seemed to be calling the shots, where the kids were saying, this is what I want it now, and the parents were kind of scurrying around and describing themselves merely as chauffeurs or as assistants. And
one of the anecdotes you tell here is of a boy, I think he's about 12 years old, whose father appeared more or less to work for him.
Yeah, no, it was a bizarre situation. At one point, this father, I asked him, I said, what's it like to leave your wife and family behind back in the East Coast and kind of move out here? And he said, well, you know, I'm doing this for my son, you know, but sometimes I feel as if I'm just a soldier in the duty of my son. And then the kid, without missing a beat, pointed his finger at his father and said, Dad, drop and give me 20. And there was this kind of awkward silence that came over us because it was just so kind of bizarre, and I was embarrassed for the father. And then we all eventually laughed because it was like the only way out of the situation. But what was interesting was after these experiences, I went and wanted to see if there was kind of a bigger picture explanation for what was going on. And as it turns out, a number of research psychologists have shown that self-importance and even narcissism is way up among American teenagers. Part of this, they believe, is the result of these self-esteem curriculum that have been in place since the 70s. And I won't bore you with the stats, but one stat that really blew me away was, since the 50s, they've been asking kids, yes or no, I am a very important person. And in the 50s, only 12% of teenagers said yes to that, whereas nowadays, 80% of teenagers say that. And I think there's nothing wrong with kids feeling good about themselves, but I think there's a sense that we've kind of overshot the mark, that it's not just positive self-esteem, it's entitlement and narcissism and these feelings that I deserve the attention of the spotlight. And that's kind of playing out on a bigger scale, even outside the realm of these conventions.
You even use a phrase for acquired narcissistic syndrome here. Let me ask you about this, because this one, as an adult, really got me. Tell us about the Association of Celebrity Personal Assistants.
Yeah, well, I'll just take a quick back step. This, I'm having my phone seems to be having a problem here.
That's all right. We're here. You go right ahead.
Okay. So, in any case, I did this survey where I asked kids which of the following jobs would you most like to have, and I gave them a list. It was U.S. Senator, CEO, celebrity personal assistant, that was it. And the kids overwhelmingly picked a celebrity personal assistant. So I wondered, was this just a kind of kids that have this skewed sense that becoming an assistant is improve your life? And it turns out this is not the case, that adults also flock to this organization called the Association of Celebrity Personal Assistants that runs its own school out in Los Angeles where you know you can go and learn what it takes to become basically the bag handler to a star.
And you talk about people that leave executive positions to go and do this because they just want to be in the reflected glory of someone who's famous.
No, that's absolutely right. I talk about a guy who left a six-figure job as the vice president of a healthcare company, and in order to become an assistant to basically a second-rate Hollywood star. So all out of this sense that somehow just being close to a celebrity is going to somehow change your life drastically. And of course, in reality, there's just an awful lot of grunt work and kind of lack of recognition that comes with being an assistant.
Is there any cure for a civilization this addicted to fame?
You know, I don't know. I guess talking about it and at least being aware of what the hidden costs are is a start.
Well, it's a start also for Americans to read your book. Congratulations on the publication of Fame Junkies, and I would commend it. Speaking to an audience largely of Christians here, I commend this especially to pastors and youth ministers, because this may have more relevance, especially dealing with adolescents and college students, but it's an indictment of the entire culture. Mr. Halpern, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, folks, to join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. What does it mean to live in a fame-infatuated culture? Do you expect to be famous? We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We're talking about America, a nation of fame junkies. That very term may sound new to you, but what we're talking about is a nation in which so many citizens seem infatuated with the rich and the famous, and with the very idea of being rich and famous. You know, it reminds me of what Daniel Boorstin, the late Librarian of Congress, wrote about a book on pseudo-events in America. It's very interesting. He said America is not only about great events in history, but about pseudo-events, things that shouldn't be events, because they're not really of consequence, but people give them an inordinate amount of attention. And he said a lot of these pseudo-events are about people who are just famous for being famous. And I think that pretty much nails it right there. There's just an awful lot of people who are famous for being famous. There's no particular talent, no particular achievement. I mean, let's face it. It doesn't take much to be a celebrity in America these days. As a matter of fact, you can be notorious. You can be caught up with a scandal, and the next thing you know, you can have some talking head position on cable television somewhere. That's America. But the really frightening part of this book, and the part that got my attention more than anything else, was the part dealing with children. Because this is a picture of the warping of future generations going on here. When you have these kids, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, going to fame school, yeah, that's what they call it. You know, you go to these schools hoping to be discovered. You go to schools, and then you go to all these shows every weekend. It's like you're pushing these kids as little actors and actresses, and most of them are never going to get anywhere. But in order to try to even get them into the potential circle where they might be discovered, you have to tell them all kinds of untruths. You have to tell them they are the cutest, they are the brightest, they are the best. You have to pump them all up, and then they live with these unfulfilled expectations. Jake Halpern, in his book Fame Junkies, describes entire neighborhoods surrounding Hollywood, California. And we're doing this show today live from Los Angeles. Entire neighborhoods of especially rental apartments where you will find parents and grandparents and others with children there just waiting to be discovered. In terms of one of the unbiblical, really sick aspects of all this, you know what these kids have to fear more than anything else? They have to fear growing up. They have to fear puberty. They have to fear adolescence. In other words, once they're not cute, they're not needed. Now, that's really, really frightening. I mean, what do you want your child to do? You want your child to mature, to grow up, but not if you want them to be discovered as a child actor or a child actress. The other interesting thing is how these children, even in the tryouts, you really get pushed into different things. You know, for instance, the script calls for the fat kid or the athletic kid or the nerd kid. And so in one of the fascinating and, frankly, rather haunting passages in this book, you have some boys showing up about 12, and they're being asked, which part are you trying out for? You trying out for the fat kid? You trying out for the athletic kid? You trying out for the nerd kid? You know, what does that communicate to a kid at that age? And it's not just the kids. This whole thing about celebrity personal assistants, I have to tell you that I know there are people looking for meaning in life, but it's hard for me to believe that you'd have people leave six-figure executive positions to go and be basically a barely paid slave to a Hollywood celebrity. In another haunting section of this book, Jake Halpern is talking with one of these celebrity assistants who says that he is really thrilled when people wave to him when he enters. And Jake Halpern says, well, aren't they really waving at the celebrity? And it's clear that his personality is just all of a sudden kind of melded into this person for whom he works. It's no longer we, it's kind of me. There's something deeply wrong there. Jake Halpern begins his book by talking about how cable television and the media in general have discovered America's infatuation with celebrity. He deals with the program Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, and he points out something I hadn't noticed, and I was no devotee of that program, but, you know, I can certainly remember that man's voice, and I can remember the basic setup of the show. But Jake Halpern points out that the rich and the famous never showed up. It was Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, but no one rich or famous was ever in the program. It's just their homes and their cars and their clubs and their clothes. Did anyone notice that this is weird? It's Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous without the actual lives of the rich and famous. But Americans nonetheless flock to this kind of programming, and they're flocking to schools, and they expect to be famous. You know, if you look at the next generation, you realize how many of them say that they would rather be famous than smart or strong. They would rather be a Hollywood celebrity, even for a brief amount of time, than an Army general or a United States senator or a medical doctor. They would rather be famous than find a cure for cancer. We're living in a very warped age. Now, I don't think humanity is fundamentally different now than 100 years ago. But fallen humanity demonstrates that fallenness in altogether new ways in every generation. And this particular attraction to a celebrity culture is not a pretty picture. I'd love to know what you think about this. Give me a call at 877-893-8255. The phone number 877-893-TALK. Coast to coast, this is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back. We're talking about fame junkies, and there are an awful lot of Americans who think the whole point of life is to be famous, and they're willing to do just about anything, sacrifice any aspect of their lives in order to achieve fame. And, of course, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, the line between fame and infamy in this culture is getting thinner and thinner all the time, harder to see. You know, is a person famous or notorious? That used to be a big distinction. I mean, back in the early 20th century, you had the famous gangsters, but they were infamous over against people who were famous for more laudatory things. Today, the line is really getting blurred. As a matter of fact, there are certain forms of art in this culture that seem to celebrate the fame of the notorious more than the fame of those that are, well, more justly famous. I'm troubled by all these young people who think the whole purpose of their lives is to find some way to be famous. Let's go to Cocoa, Florida, where Philip's on the line, listening on XM 170. Go ahead, Philip.
Hey, brother. I love your show. You could be talking about me 15 years ago. Doctor, God's endowed us with talents and a creativeness, but until we discovered Christ, our efforts for success or what we think should be fame are very misguided.
Well, Phil, that's exactly right. And, you know, I guess it gets back to the whole question of what we're here for. And, you know, I guess if you think that all of your meaning in life has to come from this life, fame might be one way to get it. But, you know, we as Christians can never believe that we're supposed to achieve that kind of fulfillment in this life. That's completely wrong. It's backwards, isn't it?
Amen. We're created for God's glory.
Wonderful reset there. That's exactly right. Theologically, we're created for God's glory. Who deserves the fame? God and God alone. And who deserves the glory? God and God alone. Any fame that human beings know is, well, you know what the old expression was? Fleeting. It's fading. I think of Shelley's poem, Ozymandias, speaking of finding that ruin in the desert sands of a man who wrote his own inscription, "I am Ozymandias. See this name and tremble." Well, no one's trembling anymore. It's a broken statue on the desert floor. Fame and power are fleeting. Let's go to Leah calling from Orlando, Florida. Go ahead, Leah.
Hi.
Glad to have you. Please go right ahead.
Well, thank you. I apologize. My question for you is just if you had thought about how this has spread into Christianity today in America with the mega churches or the high-profile pastors, and how it's looked on as a form of celebrity, and maybe, you know, even to go so far as the prostitution with the name of Jesus.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a moment, Leah. You know, do you think this is just a phenomenon of a culture that focuses on people with this kind of interest, or do you think this is something that's being fed by a more perverse kind of principle here?
Well, I think it's a combination of both, to be honest. I think that it can, you know, you can take the spiritual side of all things. But I think also is that, it, you know, you just have, we're not in the, you know, I'm not looking to be a star, per se, on the screen, but I am looking to be highly profiled as a pastor or as a famous preacher or as a traveling evangelist. And it's more about my book than it is about the name of Jesus and his saving power.
Well, that's a really important word to hear, Leah, and I appreciate your call. And, you know, I think about this knowing that some people would associate, you know, this kind of fame or celebrity with a different context. I mean, in a small town, the pastor of the, you know, the first whatever church might be quite a celebrity in that community. But, of course, we now have the mega churches you mentioned, and we also have these massive television ministries. And, you know, quite frankly, in so many cases, what we have there is fame for bad theology, fame for unbiblical teaching, and fame for an anti-gospel rather than for the gospel of Christ. And I think your call raises a very important point. You know, some kind of fame and celebrity may at some point be inevitable in a culture like this. I mean, if you're known by several thousand people, you already are some kind of celebrity. I mean, we all know this from the playground. There may be, you know, just 30 kids out on the playground, but someone is going to be, you know, better known, more famous than anyone else. But Christians better be the one, and Christian pastors in particular, who make very clear that God alone deserves the glory. And it had better be a very quick pointing of the congregation and of the public to the God we represent rather than to ourselves. A very good point, Lee. I really appreciate your call from there in Orlando, Florida. And I'm headed there in just a couple of days for the big Ligonier conference there. So I'll be visiting your city. Let's go to Kingsport, Tennessee, where Todd's on the line listening to WHCB. Go ahead, Todd.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call, Dr. Miller. I had a question about youth sports. It seems like I can see this happening in youth sports where the traveling teams and parents are sacrificing 4 or 5 nights a week and Sundays for their kid to be a better athlete in hopes of, being like the person they've seen on TV.
Yeah, well, I think that's a parallel development here. And by the way, we're going to be doing a program on that issue in the next few days because of this study out of Leadership Magazine indicating that pastors and youth pastors are saying the greatest competition in terms of their ministry right now is organized sports and activities in which children are involved. And the parents seem to think that these other things, whatever they are more important than activities related to the church and the Christian discipleship and all the rest. And that should be a troubling issue for Christian parents. We're going to be talking about that. But, Todd, I think you're right to tie that to the celebrity culture as well, because an awful lot of what happens in athletics now is celebrity culture. And that's something I didn't even think to mention. I mean, you have this blurring of athletics and celebrity. And, you know, there are an awful lot of kids who really pin their hopes on a very unrealistic future in athletics, either college or professional. It's just not going to happen. I saw a list of statistics the other day about the chances of a boy making it all the way to pro basketball. And this was the particular sport chosen. And it mentioned that a study being done of junior high school, middle school students indicated that boys wanted to be a basketball star more than any other kind of athletic achievement. And I'm told it actually pays more than other sports at the highest level. And obviously you've got an awful lot of kids that are really focused on that sport. But it mentioned that, you know, out of all of those thousands and thousands and thousands, only about 100 even make it for the tryouts in any given birth year. That's amazing right there. In any given birth year, only about 100 boys or then young men even make it for professional tryouts. You're talking about a pretty vain hope there. Todd, thanks for your call. It's great to hear from you there in Kingsport, Tennessee. Folks, what we're talking about here is a coast-to-coast phenomenon. It is really acute out here, I can tell you, on the West Coast. I'm here in Los Angeles right now doing this broadcast, and, you know, fame is just a big part of it. You've got the Hollywood Walk of Fame. You've got the gold stars in the sidewalk. You've got an entire culture of people in the entertainment business. And, you know, quite frankly, when you're walking around Beverly Hills, Hollywood, Los Angeles, just about everybody's got one icon to see who you might run into while you're out here. Well, what we run into is a cultural phenomenon that ought to have our attention. And I'll be right back. As I mentioned, one of my main concerns here is young people. Jake Halpern, in his book Fame Junkies, talks about the narcissism personality inventory that's been done since the mid-1990s. Keith Campbell at the University of Georgia does this research looking into the psychology of narcissism and entitlement. Reading from the book, you'll be interested in this. Basically, adolescents everywhere have delusions of fame and grandeur. But in America, these thoughts don't seem so far-fetched. The danger with this is that teenagers are basically being encouraged to adopt the prima donna's mindset, in which they are constantly looking to be admired because, after all, they believe their own fame is imminent. Perhaps, needless to say, the vast majority are in for a big disappointment. At that point, Jake Halperin goes on to quote the figure, the character Tyler Durden, the character in the novel Fight Club, who says, quote, "We are the middle children of history, raised by television to believe that someday we'll be millionaires and movie stars and rock stars, but we won't, and we're just learning this fact." It is a tough realization. And it's a tough realization for any generation. It's a tough realization for this generation. That's one reason why Christian parents have to raise our children in a counterculture. We have to create in our own homes and in our own churches a counterculture that says, look, let's look at what fame is. Let's understand that some people are famous just for being famous. Let's understand that fame is like a magnet that pulls things to you, even like a magnet pulls iron filings, but an awful lot of what it attracts and an awful lot of what it costs just simply is unacceptable to a Christian believer. You know, the bottom line is, as we were reminded in one of our call conversations today, that that fame is fleeting and that all fame really belongs to our Creator alone. Anything we know is at best a reflected glory. Our point is not to draw attention to ourselves, but rather attention to the Savior. That's a hard thing for all of us to remember in a fame-saturated culture, but it might be especially difficult for our children. That's why we as adults had better learn how to live so that our children, seeing us, do not see fame junkies, but those who are able to put things in a more biblical perspective. Yes, the famous are always going to be around us. They're always going to be Hollywood celebrities. They're always going to be political celebrities. And yes, as we remind on this program, even some Christian celebrities. But the only celebrity that matters is that which belongs to God and God alone. You know, we know that when we sing hymns. We know that when we read the Psalms. We know that when we think carefully. But after all, we're living in a culture that doesn't reward careful thinking, but rather wants to entice us with narcissism, pride, and the promise of celebrity. Tomorrow's Ask Anything Wednesday, you'll get to set the agenda, and as always, the conversation will be fascinating. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. Thanks to the folks here in Los Angeles who've made this possible. We'll see you on Thursday as well from Orlando, Florida. I'll meet you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.